This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Just over a decade ago, western North Dakota was a faded frontier. This vast and sparsely populated area had been steadily losing population since the Great Depression. But in 2008, things took a sharp turn. Advances in hydraulic fracturing and horizontal drilling set off the largest oil rush in recent American history. The Bakken oil fields became home to a stream of newcomers, from truck drivers looking for top-rate salaries to foreign developers. Journalist Maya Rao embedded herself to document what she calls a modern-day gold rush. Her book is Great American Outpost: Dreamers, Mavericks, and the Making of an Oil Frontier. She's in North Carolina for a reading in Raleigh tonight, but first she joins me in the studio. Maya Rao, welcome to the State of Things.
Thank you for having me.
Good to have you here. Tell us about the Bakken oil field, because I think, you know, a lot of us, this was sort of off the map for a while. It would kind of show up in periodic pieces, but where is it and what is it?
So this took place in one of the most remote areas you can imagine in western North Dakota, near the Canadian border, a really forgotten area. And they had actually known that there was oil there since the 1950s, but it wasn't until the last decade that it became more profitable to drill that advances in fracking and drilling actually led to a real oil rush. And so it became this hub of America for a while. People from all over rushed in, business people, laborers, pipeliners, oil companies. And I thought it was a really fascinating microcosm of America.
What got you interested in the story?
Well, at that time that this was heating up, I was living in Minneapolis, and a lot of people from the Midwest were going there. So I met some of them and got interested partly through that, but also I just thought it had the makings of a great book, and I knew it would be historically important for generations to come, and so I wanted to be out there on the ground and record those experiences.
You lived there for quite a while.
Right. At first, I mean, I was traveling, you know, back and forth for a number of years, but I mean, I eventually spent about a year on the ground.
And it worked as a cashier for a while, right?
Right. To get into this, I took a job for 1 month as a truck stop cashier. And that was to get a feel more from the inside. Yeah. And everything in the Bakken revolves around truck stops. And trucking is the most common job.
And tell us about what it's like to live there. I mean, talk about a remote area in North Dakota. I mean, it's tough living there, right?
Yeah, I spent most of my life on the East Coast in major metropolitan areas. It was a very big psychological hurdle to get used to being somewhere that remote. Even just driving across North Dakota, sometimes you step out at a gas station and you get really nervous because there's not a sound at all. You know, at night.
Think Fargo.
Yeah.
Think the Coen brothers. And that's the big city, right?
Fargo's a big city,
that's the
yes.
big city, exactly. So
yeah,
that seemed remote to you, yeah?
Yeah, Fargo's across the state. So a couple times during my reporting when I went out to, when I left the oil field and drove a couple hours to Bismarck or Fargo, I thought, wow, I'm in the big city again.
Right.
So yeah, you definitely feel like you're off the map. People are very busy out there. So you all, and things, it's a really closed off area in some ways, so you sort of forget what's going on in the outside world.
So you focused on and you met a man named Danny Witt, who started out from right here in North Carolina on the coast. Tell us his story and how you got to know him.
Yes, so while I was working at the truck stop, I was looking for people to interview and who could work as a subject of the book. And so you know, he, like a lot of other people, I met him at the cash register, and he seemed pretty interesting. So he agreed to let me shadow him on his work site for a day just to start. But he had a really fascinating story that was representative of the fact that many Southerners migrated to the oil field. And he had come from the Outer Banks and was looking for an opportunity to work. And so he came up there sort of in a half-baked scheme, which he will admit, you know, in interviews that he didn't really plan it out too well. Him and another friend just drove up. He went to trucking school but didn't have any practical experience and found himself in this really frozen hellscape, you know.
Well, and half-baked and Bagosh and Bagali describes pretty much his life to that point, right? I mean, he had done some things, but he was kind of hanging out, living the surfer's life, really.
Yeah, he'd been a surfer for a while. He traveled in Panama and was just looking for a more stable career. And I think, you know, I met a lot of people out there like that. They had gone here and there, and they were looking for some more stability and a longer term job opportunity.
So he hears about the opportunities there, decides to take a truck driving course, a month-long course, passes, kind of knows most of it, and then heads out to North Dakota, right?
Right. He went to a trucking school in North Carolina, and, you know, you get a CDL, or commercial driver's license, but it's not the same as getting practical on-the-ground training. And a lot of times when you graduate from trucking school, you know, you'd be going over the road on a highway, getting on-the-job training, but he didn't really get that. He just went straight to the oil field.
Well, and then Danny spoke with David Folkenflik on the program On Point on WBUR and pointed out that even if he had gotten that training, it really doesn't apply when you get to that part of North Dakota.
Well, it's extremely dangerous, and that's why they pay top dollar. They've made it much safer in recent years, and, you know, we all take that chance. These roads are not meant for semis. Another thing that's important to note is these companies do 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off. So you get time off. Many of them now pay for you to go home. And a lot of them say it's to detoxify, to get out the toxins that build up as you work on the rigs. And these are all young men's jobs. So they do allow you plenty of time to go home and all benefits.
Danny Witt, the water trucker in North Dakota, had been there since 2011. He was speaking with David Folkenflik on WBUR earlier this year, and he is the central character in the book Great American Outpost by my guest, Maya Ralph. So, well, tell us more about the trucks, and because of the roads, they were having to fix those trucks all the time, right?
Yeah, one of the important things to note about the North Dakota oil field, which is different than some other oil field areas, was that there was just a total lack of pipelines. There was no way to transport any materials like oil, fresh water, salt water. So that's why they had to have an army of trucks, which was very unsafe. So in the book, I talk about how, especially at the height of the boom, almost every day you'd see in the newspaper, there's an overturned truck, there's fatalities, people died in accidents in the ice and wind, there were drunk drivers, there's narrow turns, you know, so it was very dangerous. And people in North Dakota, they're usually not against fracking itself, but I can tell you that the trucks were something that really made it miserable for a lot of the locals and led to losses of life, led to, you know, really battered roads that had to constantly be repaired.
Yeah, and you talked about some of the ingenuity, too, including some high school students who were actually, I think there was a number of elk that were killed, and they turned it into a donation, right?
Right, they butchered it in a
because
in
there were several of them.
Class.
It wasn't one. It was like several elk, and so they figured out what to do. So it's like it does change the culture, and of course that's part of the debate about fracking. It's not only what it might do to the earth and what it might do to your water supply, but also the infrastructure and what's going to change about your community. And these are all the questions when fracking is debated. How did the folks change their ideas? Not necessarily about fracking, but how did they come to embrace this sudden explosion in population and change in the way of life up there?
Well, North Dakota that part of Western North Dakota was fairly economically depressed. They were so desperate for new blood in the early 2000s that they even started a website called PrairieOpportunity.com to try to bring people in and sell this, you know, quiet, peaceful, small-town life. But ironically, after the oil boom came, they said, wow, this is way too fast and this is way too many people. So as one guy put it to me, the prairieopportunity.com didn't necessarily work out that well, but at least it wasn't a bunch of Oklahomans and Texans tearing up the place.
No, a wide variety of people from all over the place. Yeah. I mean, that's the other interesting, one of the many other interesting things that you point out in your book. This throws together a lot of people who otherwise might not be in the same bar, right?
Right. And that's why I throughout the book, I drew a lot of comparisons into the California Gold Rush and the Klondike Gold Rush and the Alaskan pipeline boom. It was definitely part of that historic cycle that brings people, you know, of all races and socioeconomic classes and just, you know, throws everyone together.
Which doesn't always lead to understanding. I mean, you talk to, we get back to Danny Witt. Part of this, we talked about the fact that this is under native land, too. So there's a mm-hmm. reservation involved in this. And Danny was talking a little bit, maybe you can reflect for us, his observations about relationships between native and the white population that had moved in.
Right. So Danny was a part of a number of white oil workers that for a time period was, you know, he was hauling oil on this Indian reservation, the Fort Berthold Indian Reservation. And it's extremely remote, and he definitely could sense that there were a number of tribal members that didn't necessarily want people like him there. And there was a lot of misunderstanding on both sides. I've talked to other tribal environmentalists who thought that these truck drivers, like Danny, were purposely overusing their jake brakes, which make a very loud, nasty snarl to disrupt them. And so both sides were sort of suspicious of each other. But in reality, people like Danny were just trying to make a living. And even I had come in a little bit naive about some of the history there. You know, why do some of the members feel so maybe ambivalent about oil development? And, you know, the reservation there had a long history of white encroachment, you know, going back many decades.
It kind of goes back hundreds of years in terms of what we can use this land for and how we exploit it. And as you say, this is yet another gold rush in which people just rush in madly and do whatever to the landscape. But also what's interesting is that in this case, there have always been conflicts, particularly when resources are found on native land. But one of the more interesting things was a native oil company. When the Indians on the reservation said, why don't we own this stuff again, through the ownership process?
Yeah, that was something I found the most interesting to write. A lot of people saw with the Standing Rock pipeline protest a couple years ago that they think that all tribal members are against oil. So I wrote about one guy who, he's a tribal member. He decided to start his own tribal-owned oil company and drill their own wells. And the reason is that a lot of outside corporations had come and gobbled up all of the oil acreage. And drilling and operating wells actually is expensive. You do need some capital to do it. So some people have also said it probably needed to work that way to have big oil companies come in first, and then, you know, the tribes could eventually do it themselves. But you can make more money owning and operating it yourself versus just taking royalties from someone else as well.
Right, and a little more control over how the process is done. So the other side of this is that you can attract capital, of course, just because there's an idea that lots of money will get made, and that leads to some of the schemes, particularly some of the real estate schemes that you uncovered, the development schemes. Tell me more about that.
Yeah. So there were a lot of investors who came there hoping to profit, and they were not necessarily trying to drill oil wells. There's a lot of opportunity to make money in real estate out there, or at least that's what people thought at the peak of the boom. So I wrote about several men who came from the UK, and they solicited millions of dollars worldwide from various people, from Hong Kong, you know, to Greece, Spain, and they were building what's known as man camp developments. These are trailers that house male oil workers, and they, you know, you could charge a lot of money for that because there were not that many places to live at the height of the boom. And so eventually, at some point, people began complaining that they weren't getting their money, and the Securities and Exchange Commission had to swoop in and file a lawsuit. And the defendants have not answered the complaint. I don't know where they are, but there were half-built man camps they left behind. $62 million was missing.
What's interesting is you can actually, I mean, some schemes are just plain crazy and you're a little bit silly for investing in them because there's no possibility that you're going to produce the product. In this case, you could have made a lot of money by actually building the camp, right? I mean, you didn't have to cheat everybody, but that's what Gold Rush is all about, isn't it? It's about cheating somebody. Now, but tell me more about the living conditions there, because housing was in short supply. What were people doing early on as they were moving in and the housing wasn't there?
Yeah, that was a constant problem. You know, people were piling into spare rooms and sleeping in their pickup, sleeping at truck stops, you know, sleeping in man camps. A lot of my book actually focuses on somewhat of the flip side where so a lot of apartment developers did come. They were rushing to build enough apartments. Mm. And just as they really did start to solve that problem, oil prices crashed. A lot of people left. And, you know, at some point, that area got a bit overbuilt. And a lot of people, once they saw the oil economy was more volatile, they were hesitant to move in and sign a year-long apartment lease. So I met people even well into the oil development that were still living in trailers for free, you know, just because they didn't want to pay for an overpriced apartment if they didn't know that they would be able to stay here, how long their jobs would last.
It's interesting because a lot of the people you talked to in the book were really very clear-eyed about this whole thing. They knew it wouldn't last. They were just going to make hay. And so it's not like they were fooled that this thing could go on forever and oil prices would stay high forever, right?
I thought some of the average people on the ground seemed to have a better grasp of that than the business people.
Well, because they have to tell investors a story, and it's best if you try to believe it yourself if you're trying to attract that kind of investment. But if you're just there for the adventure and for the bucks, it's pretty good. And they were able to make some pretty good money. Around 2015 is when it took a sharp turn down, right?
That's right. And now oil prices have been rebounding to pretty good levels recently. You know, and so now with North Dakota, a lot of the infrastructure, it's all built. Everything is ready this time. So even when if oil prices get back up to 100, they'll still be ready for a new era.
You said you were doing this while you were doing this reporting, of course, a very interesting time politically in the United States. This is before 2016 in the run-up. The rest of America seemed a little bit, or much of America, seemed surprised at the election of Donald Trump as president of the United States. You weren't surprised.
You could definitely tell from being in Western North Dakota that there were a lot of people from all over the country who felt very marginalized, who felt fed up. They felt very distrustful of government and business and all the standard institutions. Everybody was looking for a way to get ahead, and were willing to do whatever it took to get ahead. But I mean, people were not relying on the conventional wisdom of 9 to 5 or Washington's going to solve my problems. I mean, you know, you could definitely see this anger brewing.
I mean, it's a perfect lab for that, because who would go there except somebody who had some wherewithal, some ability to take it, and a fair degree of desperation. In other words, the rest of it isn't working out for me. It's not working out for me here in the Outer Banks or wherever. So the economy isn't providing for me. I'm going to take this chance. So what a laboratory to bring all those people together who, as you say, felt a little bit on the margins. And what was your big takeaway from all this, though, as you spent so much time working there, living there, and then writing this book?
Well, I had this image that struck me the first time I went there with all these, you know, abandoned farmsteads and homesteads from many decades ago that the pioneers left behind for better pastures. And the last time I was there a couple of years ago, I saw, you know, these abandoned trailer camps from the Ponzi scheme, you know, the abandoned oil equipment, the abandoned tanks. So it felt like this cycle where that frontier seemed destined to be sort of exploited and be a place where things were abandoned. But I think it's also a story that has inspired me too. I think people like Danny are inspiring. A lot of journalists, when they write about someone who goes to the oil field, they like to write about how they didn't make it, but he actually is successful. He's struggled like a lot of people, but he's still there.
Great stuff. Maya Rao, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Maya Rao is the author of Great American Outpost, Dreamers, Mavericks, and the Making of an Oil Frontier. She's going to be reading from her book at Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh tonight at 7 o'clock, and you can get the details at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, children from Senegal join students from Greensboro to create a podcast on the environment. We'll talk about blueprints on air next on The State of Things.